Leyte, which falls into the bay, divided the two camps, and marked the advancing and retreating skirmishes of three successive and bloody days. On the fourth day, the two armies joined a more serious and decisive issue. But Alaric would have blushed at the sight of his unworthy successor, sustaining on his head a diadem of pearls, encumbered with a flowing robe of gold and silken embroidery, and reclining on a litter or car of ivory drawn by two white mules. Notwithstanding the valor of the Saracens, they fainted under the weight of multitudes, and the plain of Ceres was overspread with 16,000 of their dead bodies. "My brethren," said Tariq to his surviving companions, "the enemy is before you, the sea is behind. Whither would ye fly? Follow your general. I am resolved either to lose my life or to trample on the prostrate king of the Romans." Besides the resource of despair, he confided in the secret correspondence and nocturnal interviews of Count Julian with the sons and the brother of Vititza. The two princes and the Archbishop of Toledo occupied the most important post. Their well-timed defection broke the ranks of the Christians. Each warrior was prompted by fear or suspicion to consult his personal safety, and the remains of the Gothic army were scattered or destroyed to the flight and pursuit of the three following days. Amidst the general disorder, Roderick started from his car and mounted Aurelia, the fleetest of his horses. But he escaped from a soldier's death to perish more ignobly in the waters of the Betis or Guadalquivir. His diadem, his robes, and his courser were found on the bank. But as the body of the Gothic prince was lost in the waves, the pride and ignorance of the caliph must have been gratified with some meaner head, which was exposed in triumph before the palace of Damascus. "And such," continues a valiant historian of the Arabs, "is the fate of those kings who withdraw themselves from a field of battle." Count Julian had plunged so deep into guilt and infamy that his only hope was in the ruin of his country. After the Battle of Ceres, he recommended the most effectual measures to the victorious Saracens. "The king of the Goths is slain. Their princes are fled before you. The army is routed. The nation is astonished. Secure, with sufficient detachments, the cities of Boetica. But in person, and without delay, march to the royal city of Toledo, and allow not the distracted Christians either time or tranquillity for the election of a new monarch." Tariq listened to his advice. A Roman captive and proselyte who had been enfranchised by the caliph himself assaulted Cordova with 700 horse. He swam the river, surprised the town, and drove the Christians into the great church, where they defended themselves above 3 months. Another detachment reduced the seacoast of Boetica, which in the last period of the Moorish power has comprised in a narrow space the populous kingdom of Granada. The march of Tariq from the Betis to the Tagus was directed through the Sierra Morena that separates Andalusia and Castile, till he appeared in arms under the walls of Toledo. The most zealous of the Catholics had escaped with the relics of their saints, and if the gates were shut, it was only till the victor had subscribed a fair and reasonable capitulation. The voluntary exiles were allowed to depart with their effects. 7 churches were appropriated to the Christian worship. The archbishop and his clergy were at liberty to exercise their functions, the monks to practice or neglect their penance, and the Goths and Romans were left in all civil or criminal cases to the subordinate jurisdiction of their own laws and magistrates. But if the justice of Tariq protected the Christians, his gratitude and policy rewarded the Jews, to whose secret or open aid he was indebted for his most important acquisitions. persecuted by the kings and synods of Spain, who had often pressed the alternative of banishment or baptism, that outcast nation embraced the moment of revenge. The comparison of their past and present state was the pledge of their fidelity, and the alliance between the disciples of Moses and those of Muhammad was maintained till the final era of their common expulsion. From the royal seat of Toledo, the Arabian leader spread his conquests to the north, over the modern realms of Castile and León. But it is heedless to enumerate the cities that yielded on his approach, or again to describe the Table of Emerald, transported from the east by the Romans, acquired by the Goths among the spoils of Rome, and presented by the Arabs to the throne of Damascus. Beyond the Asturian mountains, the maritime town of Gijón was the term of the lieutenant of Musa, who had performed with the speed of a traveller his victorious march of 700 miles from the Rock of Gibraltar to the Bay of Biscay. The failure of land compelled him to retreat, and he was recalled to Toledo to exercise his presumption of subduing a kingdom in the absence of his general. Spain, which in a more savage and disorderly state had resisted 200 years the arms of the Romans, was overrun in a few months by those of the Saracens. And such was the eagerness of submission and treaty that the governor of Cordova is recorded as the only chief who fell, without conditions, a prisoner into their hands. The cause of the Goths had been irrevocably judged in the field of Ceres, and in the national dismay each part of the monarchy declined a contest with the antagonist who had vanquished the united strength of the whole. That strength had been wasted by 2 successive seasons of famine and pestilence, and the governors, who were impatient to surrender, might exaggerate the difficulty of collecting the provisions of a siege. To disarm the Christians, superstition likewise contributed her terrors, and the subtle Arab encouraged the report of dreams, omens, and prophecies, and of the portraits of the destined conquerors of Spain that were discovered on the breaking open an apartment of the royal palace. Yet a spark of the vital flame was still alive. Some invincible fugitives preferred a life of poverty and freedom in the Asturian valleys. The hardy mountaineers repulsed the slaves of the caliph, and the sword of Pelagius has been transformed into the scepter of the Catholic kings. On the intelligence of this rapid success, the applause of Musa degenerated into envy, and he began not to complain, but to fear that Tariq would leave him nothing to subdue. At the head of 10,000 Arabs and 8,000 Africans, he passed over in person from Mauritania to Spain. The first of his companions were the noblest of the Quraysh. His eldest son was left in the command of Africa. The 3 younger brethren were of an age and spirit to second the boldest enterprises of their father. At his landing in Algeciras, he was respectfully entertained by Count Julian, who stifled his inward remorse and testified, both in words and actions, that the victory of the Arabs had not impaired his attachment to their cause. Some enemies yet remained for the sword of Musa. The tardy repentance of the Goths had compared their own numbers and those of the invaders. The cities from which the march of Tariq had declined considered themselves as impregnable, and the bravest patriots defended the fortifications of Seville and Mérida. They were successively besieged and reduced by the labor of Musa, who transported his camp from the Betis to the Anas, from the Guadalquivir to the Guadiana. When he beheld the works of Roman magnificence, the bridge, the aqueducts, the triumphal arches, and the theatre of the ancient metropolis of Lusitania, "I should imagine," said he to his 4 companions, "that the human race must have united their art and power in the foundation of this city. Happy is the man who shall become its master." He aspired to that happiness, but the Emeritans sustained on this occasion the honour of their descent from the veteran legionaries of Augustus. Disdaining the confinement of their walls, they gave battle to the Arabs on the plain. But an ambuscade rising from the shelter of a quarry or a ruin chastised their indiscretion and intercepted their return. The wooden turrets of assault were rolled forwards to the foot of the rampart, but the defence of Merida was obstinate and long, and the castle of the martyrs was a perpetual testimony of the losses of the Muslims. The constancy of the besieged was at length subdued by famine and despair, and the prudent victor disguised his impatience under the names of clemency and esteem. The alternative of exile or tribute was allowed. The churches were divided between the two religions, and the wealth of those who had fallen in the siege or retired to Galicia was confiscated as the reward of the faithful. In the midway between Merida and Toledo, the lieutenant of Musa saluted the vice-regent of the caliph and conducted him to the palace of the Gothic kings. Their first interview was cold and formal. A rigid account was exacted of the treasures of Spain. The character of Tariq was exposed to suspicion and obloquy, and the hero was imprisoned, reviled, and ignominiously scourged by the hand or the command of Musa. Yet so strict was the discipline, so pure the zeal, or so tame the spirit of the primitive Muslims, that after this public indignity, Tariq could serve and be trusted in the reduction of the Tarragonest province. A mosque was erected at Saragossa by the liberality of the Quraysh. The port of Barcelona was opened to the vessels of Syria, and the Goths were pursued beyond the Pyrenean mountains into their Gallic province of Septimania or Languedoc. In the church of St. Mary at Carcassonne, Musa found, but it is improbable that he left, 7 equestrian statues of massy silver, and from his term or column of Narbonne, he returned on his footsteps to the Galician and Lusitanian shores of the ocean. During the absence of the father, his son Abdelaziz chastised the insurgents of Seville and reduced from Malaga to Valencia, the seacoast of the Mediterranean. His original treaty with the discreet and valiant Theodemir will represent the manners and policy of the times. The conditions of peace agreed and sworn between Abdelaziz, the son of Musa, the son of Nasir, and Theodemir, prince of the Goths. In the name of the most merciful God, Abdelaziz makes peace on these conditions, that Theodemir shall not be disturbed in his principality, nor any injury be offered to the life or property, the wives and children, the religion and temples of the Christians, that Theodemir shall freely deliver his 7 cities, Orihuela, Valentola, Alicante Mola, Vacasora, Bigera, now Bejar, Ora, or Opta, and Lorca, that he shall not assist or entertain the enemies of the caliph, but shall faithfully communicate his knowledge of their hostile designs, that himself and each of the Gothic nobles shall annually pay 1 piece of gold, 4 measures of wheat, as many of barley, with a certain proportion of honey, oil, and vinegar, and that each of their vassals shall be taxed at 1 moiety of the said imposition. Given the 4th of Regeb, in the year of the Hegira 94, and subscribed with the names of 4 Muslim witnesses. Theodemir and his subjects were treated with uncommon lenity, but the rate of tribute appears to have fluctuated from 1/10 to 1/5, according to the submission or obstinacy of the Christians. In this revolution, many partial calamities were inflicted by the carnal or religious passions of the enthusiasts. Some churches were profaned by the new worship. Some relics or images were confounded with idols. the rebels were put to the sword, and one town, an obscure place between Cordova and Seville, was razed to its foundations. Yet if we compare the invasion of Spain by the Goths, or its recovery by the kings of Castile and Aragon, we must applaud the moderation and discipline of the Arabian conquerors. The exploits of Musa were performed in the evening of life, though he affected to disguise his age by colouring with a red powder the whiteness of his beard. But in the love of action and glory, his breast was still fired with the ardour of youth, and the possession of Spain was considered only as the first step to the monarchy of Europe. With a powerful armament by sea and land, he was preparing to repass the Pyrenees, to extinguish in Gaul and Italy the declining kingdoms of the Franks and Lombards, and to preach the unity of God on the altar of the Vatican. From thence, subduing the barbarians of Germany, he proposed to follow the course of the Danube from its source to the Black Sea, to overthrow the Greek or Roman Empire of Constantinople, and returning from Europe to Asia, to unite his new acquisitions with Antioch and the provinces of Syria. But his vast enterprise, perhaps of easy execution, must have seemed extravagant to vulgar minds, and the visionary conqueror was soon reminded of his dependence and servitude. The friends of Tariq had effectually stated his services and wrongs. At the court of Damascus, the proceedings of Musa were blamed, his intentions were suspected, and his delay in complying with the first invitation was chastised by a harsher and more peremptory summons. An intrepid messenger of the Caliph entered his camp at Lugo in Galicia, and in the presence of the Saracens and Christians, arrested the bridle of his horse. His own loyalty, or that of his troops, inculcated the duty of obedience, and his disgrace was alleviated by the recall of his rival and the permission of investing with his two governments his two sons, Abdallah and Abdelaziz. His long triumph from Ceuta to Damascus displayed the spoils of Africa and the treasures of Spain. 400 Gothic nobles, with gold coronets and girdles, were distinguished in his train, and the number of male and female captives, selected for their birth or beauty, was computed at 18 or even at 30,000 persons. As soon as he reached Tiberias in Palestine, he was apprised of the sickness and danger of the Caliph by a private message from Suleiman, his brother and presumptive heir, who wished to reserve for his own reign the spectacle of victory. Had Walid recovered, the delay of Musa would have been criminal. He pursued his march and found an enemy on the throne. In his trial before a partial judge against a popular antagonist, he was convicted of vanity and falsehood, and a fine of 200,000 pieces of gold either exhausted his poverty or proved his rapaciousness. The unworthy treatment of Tariq was revenged by a similar indignity, and the veteran commander, after a public whipping, stood a whole day in the sun before the palace gate, till he obtained a decent exile under the pious name of a pilgrimage to Mecca. The resentment of the Caliph might have been satiated with the ruin of Musa, but his fears demanded the extirpation of a potent and injured family. A sentence of death was intimated with secrecy and speed to the trusty servants of the throne both in Africa and Spain. And the forms, if not the substance, of justice were superseded in this bloody execution. In the mosque or palace of Cordova, Abdelaziz was slain by the swords of the conspirators. They accused their governor of claiming the honors of royalty, and his scandalous marriage with Igilona, the widow of Roderick, offended the prejudices both of the Christians and Muslims. By a refinement of cruelty, the head of the son was presented to the father, with an insulting question, whether he acknowledged the features of the rebel. "I know his features," he exclaimed with indignation. I assert his innocence, and I imprecate the same, a juster fate, against the authors of his death. The age and despair of Musa raised him above the power of kings, and he expired at Mecca of the anguish of a broken heart. His rival was more favorably treated. His services were forgiven, and Tariq was permitted to mingle with the crowd of slaves. I am ignorant whether Count Julian was rewarded with the death which he deserved indeed, though not from the hands of the Saracens. But the tale of their ingratitude to the sons of Vititza is disproved by the most unquestionable evidence. The two royal youths were reinstated in the private patrimony of their father, but on the decease of Iba, the elder, his daughter was unjustly despoiled of her portion by the violence of her uncle Zigabut. The Gothic maid pleaded her cause before the Caliph Hashim and obtained the restitution of her inheritance, but she was given in marriage to a noble Arabian, and their two sons, Isaac and Ibrahim, were received in Spain with the consideration that was due to their origin and riches. A province is assimilated to the victorious state by the introduction of strangers and the imitative spirit of the natives. And Spain, which had been successively tinctured with Punic and Roman and Gothic blood, imbibed in a few generations the name and manners of the Arabs. The first conquerors and the 20 successive lieutenants of the caliphs were attended by a numerous train of civil and military followers who preferred a distant fortune to a narrow home. The private and public interest was promoted by the establishment of faithful colonies, and the cities of Spain were proud to commemorate the tribe or country of their eastern progenitors. The victorious, though motley, bands of Tariq and Musa asserted by the name of Spaniards their original claim of conquest. Yet they allowed their brethren of Egypt to share their establishments of Murcia and Lisbon. The Royal Legion of Damascus was planted at Cordova, that of Emesa at Seville, that of Kenizrin or Chalcis at Jaen, that of Palestine at Al-Jazeera and Medina Sidonia. The natives of Yemen and Persia were scattered round Toledo and the inland country, and the fertile seats of Granada were bestowed on 10,000 horsemen of Syria and Iraq, the children of the purest and most noble of the Arabian tribes. A spirit of emulation, sometimes beneficial, more frequently dangerous, was nourished by these hereditary factions. 10 years after the conquest, a map of the province was presented to the caliph. The seas, the rivers, and the harbors, the inhabitants and cities, the climate, the soil, and the mineral productions of the earth. In the space of 2 centuries, the gifts of nature were improved by the agriculture, the manufactures, and the commerce of an industrious people. And the effects of their diligence have been magnified by the idleness of their fancy. The first of the Umayyads, who reigned in Spain, solicited the support of the Christians, and in his Edict of Peace and Protection, he contents himself with a modest imposition of 10,000 ounces of gold, 10,000 pounds of silver, 10,000 horses, as many mules, 1,000 cuirasses, with an equal number of helmets and lances. The most powerful of his successors derived from the same kingdom the annual tribute of 12,045,000 dinars, or pieces of gold, about 6 millions of sterling money, a sum which, in the 10th century, most probably surpassed the united revenues of the Christian monarchs. His royal seat of Cordova contained 600 mosques, 900 baths, and 200,000 houses. He gave laws to 80 cities of the first, to 300 of the second and third order. Then the fertile banks of the Guadalquivir were adorned with 12,000 villages and hamlets. The Arabs might exaggerate the truth, but they created and they described the most prosperous era of the riches, the cultivation, and the populousness of Spain. The wars of the Muslims were sanctified by the Prophet, but among the various precepts and examples of his life, the caliphs selected the lessons of toleration that might tend to disarm the resistance of the unbelievers. Arabia was the temple and patrimony of the god of Muhammad, but he beheld with less jealousy and affection the nations of the earth. The polytheists and idolaters, who were ignorant of his name, might be lawfully extirpated by his votaries. But a wise policy supplied the obligation of justice, and after some acts of intolerant zeal, the Mohammedan conquerors of Hindustan have spared the pagodas of that devout and populous country. The disciples of Abraham, of Moses, and of Jesus were solemnly invited to accept the more perfect revelation of Muhammad. But if they preferred the payment of a moderate tribute, they were entitled to the freedom of conscience and religious worship. In a field of battle, the forfeit lives of the prisoners were redeemed by the profession of Islam. The females were bound to embrace the religion of their masters, and a race of sincere proselytes was gradually multiplied by the education of the infant captives. But the millions of African and Asiatic converts who swelled the native hand of the faithful Arabs must have been allured rather than constrained to declare their belief in one God and the Apostle of God. By the repetition of a sentence and the loss of a foreskin, the subject or the slave, the captive or the criminal, arose in a moment the free and equal companion of the victorious Muslims. Every sin was expiated. Every engagement was dissolved. The vow of celibacy was superseded by the indulgence of nature. The active spirits who slept in the cloister were awakened by the trumpet of the Saracens. And in the convulsion of the world, every member of a new society ascended to the natural level of his capacity and courage. The minds of the multitude were tempted by the invisible as well as temporal blessings of the Arabian prophet. And charity will hope that many of his proselytes entertained a serious conviction of the truth and sanctity of his revelation. In the eyes of an inquisitive polytheist, it must appear worthy of the human and the divine nature. More pure than the system of Zoroaster, more liberal than the law of Moses, the religion of Muhammad might seem less inconsistent with reason than the creed of mystery and superstition, which in the 7th century disgraced the simplicity of the gospel. In the extensive provinces of Persia and Africa, the national religion has been eradicated by the Mohammedan faith. The ambiguous theology of the Magi stood alone among the sects of the East, but the profane writings of Zoroaster might, under the reverend name of Abraham, be dexterously connected with the chain of divine revelation. Their evil principle, the demon Ahriman, might be represented as the rival or as the creature of the god of light. The temples of Persia were devoid of images, but the worship of the sun and of fire might be stigmatized as a gross and criminal idolatry. The milder sentiment was consecrated by the practice of Muhammad and the prudence of the caliphs. The Magians, or Gabers, were ranked with the Jews and Christians among the people of the written law. And as late as the 3rd century of the Hegira, the city of Herat will afford a lively contrast of private zeal and public toleration. Under the payment of an annual tribute, the Mohammedan law secured to the Gabers of Herat their civil and religious liberties. But the recent and humble mosque was overshadowed by the antique splendor of the adjoining Temple of Fire. A fanatic imam deplored in his sermons the scandalous neighborhood and accused the weakness or indifference of the faithful. Excited by his voice, the people assembled in tumult. The two houses of prayer were consumed by the flames, but the vacant ground was immediately occupied by the foundation of a new mosque. The injured Magi appealed to the sovereign of Khorasan. He promised justice and relief, when, behold, 4,000 citizens of Herat, of a grave character and mature age, unanimously swore that the idolatrous Thane had never existed. The Inquisition was silenced, and their conscience was satisfied, says the historian Michon, with this holy and meritorious perjury. But the greatest part of the temples of Persia were ruined by the insensible and general desertion of their votaries. It was insensible, since it is not accompanied with any memorial of time or place, of persecution or resistance. It was general, since the whole realm, from Shiraz to Samarkand, imbibed the faith of the Quran, and the preservation of the native tongue reveals the descent of the Mohammedans of Persia. In the mountains and deserts, an obstinate race of unbelievers adhered to the superstition of their fathers, and a faint tradition of the Magian theology is kept alive in the province of Kirman, among the banks of the Indus, among the exiles of Surat, and in the colony which in the last century was planted by Shah Abbas at the gates of Isfahan. The chief pontiff has retired to Mount Elbus, 18 leagues from the city of Yezd. The perpetual fire, if it continues to burn, is inaccessible to the profane. But his residence is the school, the oracle, and the pilgrimage of the Ghebers, whose hard and uniform features attest the unmingled purity of their blood. Under the jurisdiction of their elders, 80,000 families maintain an innocent and industrious life. Their subsistence is derived from some curious manufactures and mechanic trades, and they cultivate the earth with the fervor of a religious duty. Their ignorance withstood the despotism of Shah Abbas, who demanded, with threats and tortures, the prophetic books of Zoroaster. And this obscure remnant of the Magians is spared by the moderation or contempt of their present sovereigns. The northern coast of Africa is the only land in which the light of the gospel, after a long and perfect establishment, has been totally extinguished. The arts, which had been taught by Carthage and Rome, were involved in a cloud of ignorance. The doctrine of Cyprian and Augustine was no longer studied. 500 episcopal churches were overturned by the hostile fury of the Donatists, the Vandals, and the Moors. The zeal and numbers of the clergy declined, and the people, without discipline or knowledge or hope, submissively sunk under the yoke of the Arabian prophet. Within 50 years after the expulsion of the Greeks, a lieutenant of Africa informed the caliph that the tribute of the infidels was abolished by their conversion. And though he sought to disguise his fraud and rebellion, his specious pretense was drawn from the rapid and extensive progress of the Mohammedan faith. In the next age, an extraordinary mission of 5 bishops was detached from Alexandria to Cairoan. They were ordained by the Jacobite patriarch to cherish and revive the dying embers of Christianity. But the interposition of a foreign prelate, a stranger to the Latins, an enemy to the Catholics, supposes the decay and dissolution of the African hierarchy. It was no longer the time when the successor of St. Cyprian at the head of a numerous synod could maintain an equal contest with the ambition of the Roman pontiff. In the 11th century, the unfortunate priest who was seated on the ruins of Carthage implored the arms and the protection of the Vatican, and he bitterly complains that his naked body had been scourged by the Saracens, and that his authority was disputed by the 4 suffragans, the tottering pillars of his throne. two epistles of Gregory the Seventh are destined to soothe the distress of the Catholics and the pride of a Moorish prince. The Pope assures the Sultan that they both worship the same God, and may hope to meet in the bosom of Abraham. But the complaint that three bishops could no longer be found to consecrate a brother announces the speedy and inevitable ruin of the episcopal order. The Christians of Africa and Spain had long since submitted to the practice of circumcision and the legal abstinence from wine and pork, and the name of Mozarabes, adoptive Arabs, was applied to their civil or religious conformity. About the middle of the 12th century, the worship of Christ and the succession of pastors were abolished along the coast of Barbary, and in the kingdoms of Cordova and Seville, of Valencia and Granada. The throne of the Almohades, or Unitarians, was founded on the blindest fanaticism, and their extraordinary rigor might be provoked or justified by the recent victories and intolerant zeal of the princes of Sicily and Castile, of Aragon and Portugal. The faith of the Mozarabes was occasionally revived by the papal missionaries, and on the landing of Charles V, some families of Latin Christians were encouraged to rear their heads at Tunis and Algiers. But the seed of the gospel was quickly eradicated, and the long province from Tripoli to the Atlantic has lost all memory of the language and religion of Rome. After the revolution of 11 centuries, the Jews and Christians of the Turkish Empire enjoy the liberty of conscience which was granted by the Arabian caliphs. During the first age of the conquest, they suspected the loyalty of the Catholics, whose name of Melkites betrayed their secret attachment to the Greek emperor, while the Nestorians and Jacobites, his inveterate enemies, approved themselves the sincere and voluntary friends of the Mohammedan government. Yet this partial jealousy was healed by time and submission. The churches of Egypt were shared with the Catholics, and all the Oriental sects were included in the common benefits of toleration. The rank, the immunities, the domestic jurisdiction of the patriarchs, the bishops, and the clergy were protected by the civil magistrate. The learning of individuals recommended them to the employments of secretaries and physicians. They were enriched by the lucrative collection of the revenue, and their merit was sometimes raised to the command of cities and provinces. A caliph of the house of Abbas was heard to declare that the Christians were most worthy of trust in the administration of Persia. "The Muslims," said he, "will abuse their present fortune. The Magians regret their fallen greatness, and the Jews are impatient for their approaching deliverance. But the slaves of despotism are exposed to the alternatives of favor and disgrace. The captive churches of the East have been afflicted in every age by the avarice or bigotry of their rulers, and the ordinary and legal restraints must be offensive to the pride or the zeal of the Christians." About 200 years after Muhammad, they were separated from their fellow subjects by a turban or girdle of a less honorable color. Instead of horses or mules, they were condemned to ride on asses, in the attitude of women. Their public and private building were measured by a diminutive standard. In the streets or the baths, it is their duty to give way or bow down before the meanest of the people, and their testimony is rejected if it may tend to the prejudice of a true believer. The pomp of processions, the sound of bells or of psalmody, is interdicted in their worship. A decent reverence for the national faith is imposed on their sermons and conversations, and the sacrilegious attempt to enter a mosque or to seduce a Muslim will not be suffered to escape with impunity. In a time, however, of tranquility and justice, the Christians have never been compelled to renounce the gospel or to embrace the Quran. but the punishment of death is inflicted upon the apostates who have professed and deserted the law of Muhammad. The martyrs of Cordova provoked the sentences of the Qadi by the public confession of their inconstancy, or their passionate invectives against the person and religion of the Prophet. At the end of the first century of the Hegira, the caliphs were the most potent and absolute monarchs of the globe. Their prerogative was not circumscribed, either in right or in fact, by the power of the nobles, the freedom of the commons, the privileges of the church, the votes of a senate, or the memory of a free constitution. The authority of the companions of Muhammad expired with their lives, and the chiefs or emirs of the Arabian tribes left behind, in the desert, the spirit of equality and independence. The regal and sacerdotal characters were united in the successors of Muhammad, and if the Quran was the rule of their actions, they were the supreme judges and interpreters of that divine book. They reigned by the right of conquest over the nations of the East, to whom the name of liberty was unknown, and who were accustomed to applaud in their tyrants the acts of violence and severity that were exercised at their own expense. Under the last of the Umayyads, the Arabian Empire extended 200 days' journey from east to west, from the confines of Tartary and India to the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, and if we retrench the sleeve of the robe, as it is styled by their writers, the long and narrow province of Africa, the solid and compact dominion from Pagana to Aden, from Tarsus to Surat, will spread on every side to the measure of 4 or 5 months of the march of a caravan. We should vainly seek the indissoluble union and easy obedience that pervaded the government of Augustus and the Antonines. But the progress of the Mohammedan religion diffused over this ample space a general resemblance of manners and opinions. The language and laws of the Quran were studied with equal devotion at Samarkand and Seville. The Moor and the Indian embraced as countrymen and brothers in the pilgrimage of Mecca, and the Arabian language was adopted as the popular idiom in all the provinces to the westward of the Tigris. Chapter 52. The two sieges of Constantinople by the Arabs. Their invasion of France and defeat by Charles Martel. Civil war of the Umayyads and Abbasids. Learning of the Arabs. Luxury of the caliphs. Naval enterprises on Crete, Sicily, and Rome. Decay and division of the empire of the caliphs. Defeats and victories of the Greek emperors. When the Arabs first issued from the desert, they must have been surprised at the ease and rapidity of their own success. But when they advanced in the career of victory to the banks of the Indus and the summit of the Pyrenees, when they had repeatedly tried the edge of their scimitars and the energy of their faith, they might be equally astonished that any nation could resist their invincible arms, that any boundary should confine the dominion of the successor of the Prophet. The confidence of soldiers and fanatics may indeed be excused, since the calm historian of the present hour, who strives to follow the rapid course of the Saracens, must study to explain by what means the church and state were saved from this impending and, as it should seem, from this inevitable danger. The deserts of Scythia and Sarmatia might be guarded by their extent, their climate, their poverty, and the courage of the northern shepherds. China was remote and inaccessible. but the greatest part of the temperate zone was subject to the Mohammedan conquerors. The Greeks were exhausted by the calamities of war and the loss of their fairest provinces, and the barbarians of Europe might justly tremble at the precipitate fall of the Gothic monarchy. In this inquiry I shall unfold the events that rescued our ancestors of Britain and our neighbors of Gaul from the civil and religious yoke of the Quran, that protected the majesty of Rome and delayed the servitude of Constantinople, that invigorated the defense of the Christians and scattered among their enemies the seeds of division and decay. 46 years after the flight of Muhammad from Mecca, his disciples appeared in arms under the walls of Constantinople. They were animated by a genuine or fictitious saying of the prophet that to the first army which besieged the city of the Caesars, their sins were forgiven. The long series of Roman triumphs would be meritoriously transferred to the conquerors of New Rome, and the wealth of nations was deposited in this well-chosen seat of royalty and commerce. No sooner had the caliph Muawiyah suppressed his rivals and established his throne than he aspired to expiate the guilt of civil blood by the success and glory of this holy expedition. His preparations by sea and land were adequate to the importance of the object. His standard was entrusted to Sophian, a veteran warrior, but the troops were encouraged by the example and presence of Yezid, the son and presumptive heir of the commander of the faithful. The Greeks had little to hope, nor had their enemies any reason of fear from the courage and vigilance of the reigning emperor, who disgraced the name of Constantine and imitated only the inglorious years of his grandfather Heraclius. Without delay or opposition, the naval forces of the Saracens passed through the unguarded channel of the Hellespont, which even now, under the feeble and disorderly government of the Turks, is maintained as the natural bulwark of the capital. The Arabian fleet cast anchor, and the troops were disembarked near the palace of Hebdomun, 7 miles from the city. During many days, from the dawn of light to the evening, the line of assault was extended from the Golden Gate to the eastern promontory, and the foremost warriors were impelled by the weight and effort of the succeeding columns. But the besiegers had formed an insufficient estimate of the strength and resources of Constantinople. The solid and lofty walls were guarded by numbers and discipline. The spirit of the Romans was rekindled by the last danger of their religion and empire. The fugitives from the conquered provinces more successfully renewed the defense of Damascus and Alexandria, and the Saracens were dismayed by the strange and prodigious effects of artificial fire. This firm and effectual resistance diverted their arms to the more easy attempt of plundering the European and Asiatic coasts of the Propontis, and after keeping the sea from the month of April to that of September, on the approach of winter, they retreated 80 miles from the capital to the Isle of Cyzicus, in which they had established their magazine of spoil and provisions. So patient was their perseverance, or so languid were their operations, that they repeated in the 6 following summers the same attack and retreat, with a gradual abatement of hope and vigor, till the mischances of shipwreck and disease, of the sword and of fire, compelled them to relinquish the fruitless enterprise. They might bewail the loss or commemorate the martyrdom of 30,000 Muslims who fell in the siege of Constantinople, and the solemn funeral of Abu Ayyub, or Job, excited the curiosity of the Christians themselves. That venerable Arab, one of the last of the companions of Muhammad, was numbered among the Ansars, or auxiliaries of Medina, who sheltered the head of the flying prophet. In his youth he fought at Badr and Uhud under the holy standard. In his mature age he was the friend and follower of Ali, and the last remnant of his strength and life was consumed in a distant and dangerous war against the enemies of the Quran. His memory was revered, but the place of his burial was neglected and unknown during a period of 780 years, till the conquest of Constantinople by Muhammad II. A seasonable vision, for such are the manufacture of every religion, revealed the holy spot at the foot of the walls and the bottom of the harbour. And the Mosque of Ayyub has been deservedly chosen for the simple and martial inauguration of the Turkish sultans. The event of the siege revived, both in the east and west, the reputation of the Roman arms, and cast a momentary shade over the glories of the Saracens. The Greek ambassador was favorably received at Damascus, a general council of the emirs, or Quraysh. A peace or truce of 30 years was ratified between the two empires, and the stipulation of an annual tribute, 50 horses of a noble breed, 50 slaves, and 3,000 pieces of gold, degraded the majesty of the commander of the faithful. The aged caliph was desirous of possessing his dominions and ending his days in tranquillity and repose. While the Moors and Indians trembled at his name, his palace and city of Damascus was insulted by the Mardites, or Maronites, of Mount Libanus, the firmest barrier of the empire, till they were disarmed and transplanted by the suspicious policy of the Greeks. After the revolt of Arabia and Persia, the house of Omiyyah was reduced to the kingdoms of Syria and Egypt. Their distress and fear enforced their compliance with the pressing demands of the Christians, and the tribute was increased to a slave, a horse, and 1,000 pieces of gold for each of the 365 days of the solar year. But as soon as the empire was again united by the arms and policy of Abd al-Malik, he disclaimed a badge of servitude not less injurious to his conscience than to his pride. He discontinued the payment of the tribute, and the resentment of the Greeks was disabled from action by the mad tyranny of the second Justinian, the just rebellion of his subjects, and the frequent change of his antagonists and successors. Till the reign of Abd al-Malik, the Saracens had been content with the free possession of the Persian and Roman treasures and the coins of Khosroes and Caesar. By the command of that caliph, a national mint was established, both for silver and gold, and the inscription of the dinar, though it might be censured by some timorous causists, proclaimed the unity of the god of Muhammad. Under the reign of the caliph Walid, the Greek language and characters were excluded from the accounts of the public revenue. If this change was productive of the invention or familiar use of our present numerals, the Arabic or Indian ciphers, as they are commonly styled, a regulation of office has promoted the most important discoveries of arithmetic, algebra, and the mathematical sciences. Whilst the Caliph Walid sat idle on the throne of Damascus, whilst his lieutenants achieved the conquest of Transoxiana and Spain, a third of Saracens overspread the provinces of Asia Minor and approached the borders of the Byzantine capital. But the attempt and disgrace of the second siege was reserved for his brother Suleiman, whose ambition appears to have been quickened by a more active and martial spirit. Then the revolutions of the Greek Empire, after the tyrant Justinian had been punished and avenged, an humble secretary, Anastasius or Artemius, was promoted by chance or merit to the vacant purple. He was alarmed by the sound of war, and his ambassador returned from Damascus with the tremendous news that the Saracens were preparing an armament by sea and land such as would transcend the experience of the past or the belief of the present age. The precautions of Anastasius were not unworthy of his station or of the impending danger. He issued a peremptory mandate that all persons who were not provided with the means of subsistence for a 3 years' siege should evacuate the city. The public granaries and arsenals were abundantly replenished. The walls were restored and strengthened, and the engines for casting stones or darts or fire were stationed along the ramparts or in the brigantines of war, of which an additional number was hastily constructed. To prevent is safer, as well as more honorable, than to repel an attack, and a design was meditated above the usual spirit of the Greeks of burning the naval stores of the enemy, the cypress timber that had been hewn in Mount Libanus, and was piled along the seashore of Phoenicia for the service of the Egyptian fleet. This generous enterprise was defeated by the cowardice or treachery of the troops, who, in the new language of the empire, were styled of the obsequian theme. They murdered their chief, deserted their standard in the Isle of Rhodes, dispersed themselves over the adjacent continent, and deserved pardon or reward by investing with the purple a simple officer of the revenue. The name of Theodosius might recommend him to the Senate and people, but after some months he sunk into a cloister and resigned to the firmer hand of Leo the Isaurian, the urgent defense of the capital and empire. The most formidable of the Saracens, Moslemah, the brother of the caliph, was advancing at the head of 120,000 Arabs and Persians, the greater part mounted on horses or camels, and the successful sieges of Tyana, Amorium, and Pergamus were of sufficient duration to exercise their skill and to elevate their hopes. At the well-known passage of Abydos on the Hellespont, the Mohammedan arms were transported, for the first time, from Asia to Europe. From thence, wheeling round the Thracian cities of the Propontis, Moslemah invested Constantinople on the land side, surrounded his camp with a ditch and rampart, prepared and planted his engines of assault, and declared, by words and actions, a patient resolution of expecting the return of seed-time and harvest, should the obstinacy of the besieged prove equal to his own. The Greeks would gladly have ransomed their religion and empire by a fine or assessment of a piece of gold on the head of each inhabitant of the city. But the liberal offer was rejected with disdain, and the presumption of Moslemah was exalted by the speedy approach and invincible force of the natives of Egypt and Syria. They are said to have amounted to 1,800 ships. The number betrays their inconsiderable size. And of the 20 stout and capacious vessels whose magnitude impeded their progress, each was manned with no more than 100 heavy armed soldiers. This huge armada proceeded on a smooth sea, and with a gentle gale, towards the mouth of the Bosphorus. The surface of the strait was overshadowed in the language of the Greeks with a moving forest, and the same fatal night had been fixed by the Saracen chief for a general assault by sea and land. To allure the confidence of the enemy, the emperor had thrown aside the chain that usually guarded the entrance of the harbour. But while they hesitated whether they should seize the opportunity or apprehend the snare, the ministers of destruction were at hand. The fireships of the Greeks were launched against them. The Arabs, their arms and vessels, were involved in the same flames. The disorderly fugitives were dashed against each other or overwhelmed in the waves, and I no longer find a vestige of the fleet that had threatened to extirpate the Roman name. A still more fatal and irreparable loss was that of the Caliph Suleiman, who died of an indigestion in his camp near Kinizrin, or Chalcis, in Syria, as he was preparing to lead against Constantinople the remaining forces of the East. The brother of Moslemah was succeeded by a kinsman and an enemy, and the throne of an active and able prince was degraded by the useless and pernicious virtues of a bigot. While he started and satisfied the scruples of a blind conscience, the siege was continued through the winter by the neglect rather than by the resolution of the Caliph Omar. The winter proved uncommonly rigorous. Above 100 days the ground was covered with deep snow, and the natives of the sultry climes of Egypt and Arabia lay torpid and almost lifeless in their frozen camp. They revived on the return of spring. A second effort had been made in their favor, and their distress was relieved by the arrival of 2 numerous fleets laden with corn and arms and soldiers. The first from Alexandria of 400 transports and galleys, the second of 360 vessels from the ports of Africa. But the Greek fires were again kindled, and if the destruction was less complete, it was owing to the experience which had taught the Muslims to remain at a safe distance or to the perfidy of the Egyptian mariners, who deserted with their ships to the emperor of the Christians. The trade and navigation of the capital were restored, and the produce of the fisheries supplied the wants and even the luxury of the inhabitants. But the calamities of famine and disease were soon felt by the troops of Muslimah, and as the former was miserably assuaged, so the latter was dreadfully propagated by the pernicious nutriment which hunger compelled them to extract from the most unclean or unnatural food. The spirit of conquest and even of enthusiasm was extinct. The Saracens could no longer struggle beyond their lines, either single or in small parties, without exposing themselves to the merciless retaliation of the Thracian peasants. An army of Bulgarians was attracted from the Danube by the gifts and promises of Leo, and these savage auxiliaries made some atonement for the evils which they had inflicted on the empire by the defeat and slaughter of 22,000 Asiatics. A report was dexterously scattered that the Franks, the unknown nations of the Latin world, were arming by sea and land in the defense of the Christian cause, and their formidable aid was expected with far different sensations in the camp and city. At length, after a siege of 13 months, the hopeless Muslimah received from the caliph the welcome permission of retreat. The march of the Arabian cavalry over the Hellespont and through the provinces of Asia was executed without delay or molestation. But an army of their brethren had been cut in pieces on the side of Bithynia, and the remains of the fleet were so repeatedly damaged by tempest and fire that only 5 galleys entered the port of Alexandria to relate the tale of their various and almost incredible disasters. In the 2 sieges, the deliverance of Constantinople may be chiefly ascribed to the novelty, the terrors, and the real efficacy of the Greek fire. The important secret of compounding and directing this artificial flame was imparted by Callinicus, a native of Heliopolis in Syria, who deserted from the service of the caliph to that of the emperor. The skill of a chemist and engineer was equivalent to the succor of fleets and armies. And this discovery or improvement of the military art was fortunately reserved for the distressful period when the degenerate Romans of the East were incapable of contending with the warlike enthusiasm and youthful vigor of the Saracens. The historian who presumes to analyze this extraordinary composition should suspect his own ignorance and that of his Byzantine guides, so prone to the marvelous, so careless, and in this instance, so jealous of the truth. From their obscure and perhaps fallacious hints, it should seem that the principal ingredient of the Greek fire was the naphtha, or liquid bitumen, a light, tenacious, and inflammable oil which springs from the earth and catches fire as soon as it comes in contact with the air. The naphtha was mingled, I know not by what methods or in what proportions, with sulphur and with the pitch that is extracted from evergreen firs. From this mixture, which produced a thick smoke and a loud explosion, proceeded a fierce and obstinate flame which not only rose in perpendicular ascent, but likewise burnt with equal vehemence in descent or lateral progress. Instead of being extinguished, it was nourished and quickened by the element of water, and sand, urine, or vinegar were the only remedies that could damp the fury of this powerful agent, which was justly denominated by the Greeks the liquid or the maritime fire. For the annoyance of the enemy, it was employed with equal effect by sea and land, in battles or in sieges. It was either poured from the rampart in large boilers, or launched in red-hot balls of stone and iron, or darted in arrows and javelins, twisted round with flax and tow, which had deeply imbibed the inflammable oil. Sometimes it was deposited in fireships, the victims and instruments of a more ample revenge, and was most commonly blown through long tubes of copper which were planted on the prow of a galley, and fancifully shaped into the mouths of savage monsters that seemed to vomit a stream of liquid and consuming fire. This important art was preserved at Constantinople as the palladium of the state. The galleys and artillery might occasionally be lent to the allies of Rome, but the composition of the Greek fire was concealed with the most jealous scruple, and the terror of the enemies was increased and prolonged by their ignorance and surprise. In the treaties of the administration of the empire, the royal author suggests the answers and excuses that might best elude the indiscreet curiosity and importunate demands of the barbarians. They should be told that the mystery of the Greek fire had been revealed by an angel to the first and greatest of the Constantines, with a sacred injunction that this gift of heaven, this peculiar blessing of the Romans, should never be communicated to any foreign nation, that the prince and the subject were alike bound to religious silence under the temporal and spiritual penalties of treason and sacrilege, and that the impious attempt would provoke the sudden and supernatural vengeance of the God of the Christians. By these precautions the secret was confined, about 400 years, to the Romans of the East, and at the end of the 11th century the Pisans, to whom every sea and every art were familiar, suffered the effects without understanding the composition of the Greek fire. It was at length either discovered or stolen by the Mohammedans, and in the holy wars of Syria and Egypt they retorted an invention contrived against themselves on the heads of the Christians. A knight who despised the swords and lances of the Saracens relates with heartfelt sincerity his own fears and those of his companions at the sight and sound of the mischievous engine that discharged a torrent of the Greek fire, the feu grégois, as it is styled by the more early of the French writers. It came flying through the air, says Joinville, like a winged, long-tailed dragon, about the thickness of a hogshead, with the report of thunder and the velocity of lightning, and the darkness of the night was dispelled by this deadly illumination. The use of the Greek, or as it might now be called, of the Saracen fire, was continued to the middle of the 14th century, when the scientific or casual compound of nitre, sulphur, and charcoal effected a new revolution in the art of war and the history of mankind. Constantinople and the Greek fire might exclude the Arabs from the eastern entrance of Europe, but in the west, on the side of the Pyrenees, the provinces of Gaul were threatened and invaded by the conquerors of Spain. The decline of the French monarchy invited the attack of these insatiate fanatics. The descendants of Clovis had lost the inheritance of his martial and ferocious spirit, and their misfortune, or demerit, has affixed the epithet of lazy to the last kings of the Merovingian race. They ascended the throne without power, and sunk into the grave without a name. A country palace in the neighborhood of Compiègne was allotted for their residence or prison, but each year, in the month of March or May, they were conducted in a wagon drawn by oxen to the assembly of the Franks, to give audience to foreign ambassadors and to ratify the acts of the mayor of the palace. That domestic officer was become the minister of the nation and the master of the prince. A public employment was converted into the patrimony of a private family. The elder Pepin left a king of mature years under the guardianship of his own widow and her child, and these feeble regents were forcibly dispossessed by the most active of